like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Terry Woodford, who has extensive experience as a record producer, recording engineer, and songwriter, having worked in one capacity or another with such artists as the Commodores, Hank Williams Jr., and the Temptations, among many others. His focus these days is canine lullabies, music designed to calm frightened barking dogs in shelters and rescue settings, making them more relaxed and comfortable and more adoptable. We'll hear a bit about his music biz career and other parts of the road he traveled toward creating canine lullabies and how those lullabies actually work when I speak with Terry Woodford in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak with Dina Athanasi of Animal Coalition of Tampa, ACT, about ACT's 11th annual Spaghetti and No Balls Dinner happening this Saturday, May 19th at Yuengling Brewery in Tampa. Major fundraiser, one of their two major ones of the year, I believe. We'll find out more from Dina. And I do have it on good authority that I'll be emceeing the evening. And it's incumbent on me to mention that exactly 2 weeks from today, WNF Summer Fun Drive begins. So on the morning of May 30th, I'll be asking for you to donate in support of Talking Animals and WNF. But I'd really like to urge you not to wait till then, hoping that if you're a Talking Animals fan, if you appreciate the interviews and other elements of the show I bring you each week, that you'll pledge today by going to the Talking Animals tip jar or sending me an email at duncan@wmnf.org to work out the pledge. You might especially want to go that route if you think you might be interested in one or more of our exclusive thank you gifts, which include one pair of fantastic tickets to see Paul Simon on his farewell tour, copies of Aaron Greenwood's new great book, Your Robot Dog Will Die, signed by Aaron, specifically for Talking Animals listeners, tickets to see the amazing comedian and Sirius radio star Jim Norton, among other gifts you can only get by pledging in support of Talking Animals. Right now, though, let's get to Terry with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Terry Woodford on Talking Animals. Good morning, Terry.
Morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining me today on Talking Animals.
Well, thanks for having me on.
You bet. So I'm eager, of course, to discuss various aspects of canine lullabies, which just seems like a really intriguing and powerful boost to the prospects of shelter dogs and others getting adopted. But as often the case, maybe more so in this instance, the steps before that over many years that ultimately led to the path of creating canine lullabies, I think we should really kind of delve into that first. So let's talk some about your music biz career. Take us on a guided tour, if you would, of that career. Any work that in that realm that begins in Muscle Shoals always bodes well, if you ask me.
Well, thank you. That's where I started out, is in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. I went to high school here, went to undergraduate school and graduate school, and then came back and got into the music industry after getting a degree in textile engineering, so go figure. Initially, my partner and I, Clayton Ivey, signed with Motown Records as an exclusive record producer and songwriter, and produced the Temptations and the Commodores and Supremes and Thelma Houston. And then after we got out of that, we built a recording studio called Wishbone Recording Studios and got hits on groups like Hot, Hank Williams Jr., just John Kay, Steppenwolf, Brenda Lee. It's just, we really had a good run there for a long time. And then one day I was asked to come up with music for kids in a daycare center.
I don't want to leave the music part too fast here. You worked some pretty major acts. So tell me about some of the ways you teamed with some of those artists that you mentioned, whether that was writing some music in some cases or serving as recording engineer or producing your records. Give us a little bit more of a sense of some of the artists you mentioned, what your involvement was with
them.
Well,
all the ones I mentioned, we either produced and wrote songs for them and engineered and recorded their record. Particularly one that was a big record for us way back was called The Angel in Your Arms This Morning Will Be the Devil in Someone Else's Arms Tonight. It was a big hit by a group named Hot, and later a big hit by Barbara Mandrell. Then we published Old Flame for the group Alabama, produced Mac McAnally, who's currently still out there on the road. And our primary focus was to have a recording studio where we could produce our own records and develop songwriters. Of the 11 songwriters we had, all had at least one number one record, and some of them, four of them, in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. So
wow.
That was our focus. We weren't really a rental studio per se. And so that was exciting times. You know, people, and you find that they're, most of the artists themselves are pretty down home and a little bit insecure, and they let you be the boss when you're making the records. So that was fun.
Well, and plus I would imagine that once you guys had a couple of major records, hits or whatever, people were probably even more inclined to say, hey, well, these guys know what they're doing. Let me accept their guidance and let's make some more.
You know, it's really hard. You might have a big hit record, but it's hard to get that second big hit record.
Yeah.
And so I think people came to Muscle Shoals, Alabama to record because, you know, people like Percy Sledge, who was a orderly at the hospital, and the guys that wrote When a Man Loves a Woman were gasoline station attendants. And so these big artists said, hey, I want to go where they're recording hits. They're onto something. And granted, once you get a hit, then you get a lot more business. And a lot of these artists are already semi-famous, if not famous. So that gives you a better chance to get a hit than trying to start with a new artist.
And also, I think I saw with some of the artists listed that you had worked with in one capacity or another, I think I saw Jimmy Buffett.
Right.
Now, when did you work with him and for how long? And again, in what capacity did you work with him?
Well, Mac McAnally was one of our songwriters, and we produced his first four albums. He's Jimmy Buffett's producer and plays on the road with him even now. And so Mac had gotten songs cut by Jimmy Buffett, so we published songs for Jimmy. I didn't get to produce him, although I think he did record an album at one of the other studios, Muscle Shoals Sound, here in Muscle Shoals. So that was more in a publishing, you know.
Okay, so you didn't have direct contact so much with Jimmy.
Well, I talked to him on the phone a few times.
Yeah. Well, no, just because part of the thing I was interested about him, you know, relative to maybe some of the other folks who were obviously a lot of greats that you worked with, but I was just curious if you had spent time in the studio or just otherwise spent time with him, to what extent that he would have even then evidenced this kind of a sort of unusual entrepreneurial spirit that we all now know is quite something. So I figure at the very least, even when you, whatever dealings you have with him, he was probably pretty ambitious at the least.
Well, you have to admire Jimmy Buffett for one thing for sure. He's a great marketer.
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody can sell you hats that are called parrot heads, he's good.
But I mean, really, if you look at the whole empire at this point, that's why I was just sort of interested to see if there's any way to sort of trace that back a little bit from those earlier days. But he's kind of in his own category in that regard. So
he sells out every show. And I know I just moved back to Muscle Shoals from Colorado, and he's going to play out there. He'll fill the Colorado Rockies baseball stadium. So see how popular he is.
But I mean, it's extended into so many areas. And of course, now he's got this Broadway play and obviously all the drinks and the resorts. And I mean, it's just so anyway, I just was sort of interested to see if there were glimmers of that back then. But anyway,
I don't know that he had that vision that he could expand it that way, but he certainly has done an amazing job, in particularly with his restaurants in Las Vegas. You know, it's just unbelievable. Jimmy Buffett's everywhere.
For sure. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Terry Woodford, who, as we're hearing, was a music biz veteran, songwriter, record producer, recording engineer for a slew of major artists. More recently, he's focused his attention on various other projects, including Canine Lullabies, music designed to calm frightened dogs in shelters, helping make them more adoptable. If you'd like to ask Terry a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So at some point, I guess either in the midst of that or maybe in the wake of the producing and other things that we've talked about, publishing, etc., you began teaching some of those skills and developing what I gather, at least, was the first, I guess, what, four-year college curriculum focused on the music industry?
Yes. You know, when I got in the music industry, there wasn't any schools for it. And what I realized was the people who knew the ins and out would take advantage of people who didn't. And creative people don't necessarily want to be or are good business people.
Yeah.
So I felt it was important to try to teach these young creative people the ins and outs of the music business, and co-founded the degree program at the University of North Alabama here in Florence. And a lot of my students have become very successful in the music industry, and not only as songwriters and artists, but as publishers and business people. And so for me, that's probably one of the most rewarding things that I can think about in the music business, was to see these people develop and not get taken advantage of. So I taught the courses in songwriting and music publishing in the record company, and the students would actually make their own records and market them and try to sell them and own the publishing companies. And so they were getting the real life experience in the music industry. And of course, that program is still going and having more successful people coming out of it. So
that's great. So you really did launch and mentor a number of people. And also, it seems like kind of one trait of your career, having kind of gotten up to speed in recent days, is that you do seem to make either an unusual move or sort of pioneering something like this 4-year degree. Obviously, had not been done before, and some things that we're here to talk about today certainly were new, or that you were kind of inventing as you went along. So, in fact, speaking of that, tell me about the request you received. You touched on it earlier, but I wanted to develop a little bit more about the music side of your career, or music biz side of your career, I guess I should say. So tell me a little bit about the request you received to help children sleep better, or sleep at all at nap time. I mean, first of all, why did someone direct that request at you?
Well, I was a judge in an arts festival in Huntsville, Alabama, and the person assigned to me was a recreational therapist in daycares. And she said, you know, we really need music that's not so condescending for our kids. You know, what could you make some music for us? And I don't want to admit this, but I have to. At that time, I thought, are you kidding me? I'm a big-time record producer. I don't want to make music for kids.
Yeah, right.
You don't get that played on the radio, you know.
Yeah, that's not the world I work in.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I started thinking about it. Well, anyway, I thought, well, one place they use music is in nap time, I would assume. So I decided there's no point in reinventing the wheel. I'll just use traditional lullabies that have been around for 200 or 300 years. But I knew if I did that, and my peers found out I was producing lullabies, they'd think for sure he's on the way out. I decided to record the human heart from the chest and use it as the rhythm or the drums of these traditional lullabies. And if you've ever noticed, lullabies don't usually have any percussion on them at all. And it became a technical challenge to record that heart and get it to reproduce on cheap players, because the speakers are so small, they don't have good bass response. The other surprise, I don't know why, but I forgot that heart doesn't beat in tempo, so we had to metronomize it and record it one beat at a time. This was before you had samplers. So I got 5 songs done and had it tested at Helen Keller Hospital and the newborn nursery, and they said that 94% of crying babies would stop crying in less than 2 minutes when you played it. And I thought, well, that's cool, but don't all babies cry in newborn nurseries, you know? Then I got a call from the University of Alabama in Birmingham, where in the cardiac recovery unit, and they'd gotten a hold of one of the cassettes at the time. And they invited me to come down. They said, we want to talk to you about these heartbeat lullabies. And I went down there, and I thought I was going to meet him in an office. And, of course, this is the University of Alabama, and I went to Auburn, so I'd have to lower myself to go down there. Anyway, they took me in the cardiac recovery unit, and I almost passed out. I saw little babies cut from the neck to their belly button and tubes and monitors, and I had to put my head between my legs. But the nurses were real excited to show me how it worked. And so I saw this one little baby's heart rate was about 200 beats a minute, and they started playing London Bridge. Within 15 seconds, the heart rate started coming down, and their breathing was regulated. And frankly, it scared me. I knew I hadn't done that, and I could really feel the presence of God in that room. And so from that point on, the nurses also said to me, is there any way, I only had 5 songs, could you add more songs, because the nurses are getting tired of hearing the same 5 songs? And then they asked me if I could figure out a way to play it at a lower volume and it still be effective. So I was pretty fired up and went back and forth to Birmingham for, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, adding songs, changing the mixes, see what the babies responded to the best, and decided to get out of the music industry and pursue this. And went to Atlanta. In fact, one of the first hospitals in the United States to use these, Resolve Children's Hospital there in your part of the country, in Tampa General.
Oh, wow.
And so I would go around speaking to nurses and doctors and eventually social workers. One of my customers is the military, who buys them to help prevent infant abuse, because crying is the primary trigger for infant abuse, and these will stop babies from crying in just a few seconds.
Wow.
So that was my focus. I was, you know, that was what I was excited about, and did a lot of talk radio and television talk shows. I remember a guy there in Tampa who was a big help to me was a guy named Joe Murphy, and he had a television show called Murphy in the Morning, and I used to do that show and really had a lot of fun with him. Don't know whether he's still there or not, but...
I'm not sure. I'm not a longtime Tampa guy, so I'm not really sure about that, Terry. But let me ask you, let me go back a little bit to, I assume kind of tongue-in-cheek, you were saying that the initial idea when this thought of trying to help kids, we're being asked to help kids, and you said, well, I don't know about that, and my colleagues will think I've kind of lost a step at least. And then
I was always putting my audiences to sleep to tell you the truth. But
that's good. But it sounded like, related to that, if I followed your explanation, that was part of how you arrived at the idea of recording the sound of a human heart, which it seems like it's kind of pivotal to the impact that this has on humans. And in a few minutes, we'll, of course, get into its impact on animals. But where did that idea come from? I mean, was it just a brainstorm, like some kind of epiphany of like, well, what could I do or what could I add that would have this impact to merge or marry with a traditional lullaby? I mean, how did that idea first come to you?
Well, when you hold a baby, you hold them right next to your chest, so they can feel that heartbeat. I don't know whether they can hear it that well or not.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly when they're in the womb, they feel and hear that human heartbeat. And so I thought that was it. I mean, I just thought that makes sense. But it was hard to record it from the chest because it kept getting body noises and breathing. And so you had to equalize it and filter it. You know, I bought little Radio Shack speakers that were about an inch in diameter and probably blew up about 10 or 15 of those trying to get them to reproduce. And so it was more of a technical challenge. I didn't know whether it was going to work or not.
But also it was interesting because you mentioned that the observation that lullabies, for fairly obvious reasons, don't have much rhythmic element to it. And yet you were adding kind of a rhythmic pulse, obviously, by way of the heartbeat. So you must have thought, okay, well, this is what babies feel if they don't hear it when someone's holding them. So let's try this. And yet we got to be careful about going too far into something too rhythmic. Otherwise, I guess it would offset the impact of the lullaby itself.
Well, of course, the lullabies, even though most lullabies don't have percussion, they're still in tempo.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And what I also learned was that the basic principles of relaxation and learning are the same. They're not only the same for humans, but they're the same for mammals and dogs and cats. And that's simplicity, repetition, predictability, consistent tempo, consistent volume, and structure, order.
Yeah.
If we're in a chaotic environment, we're drawn towards structure and order. And so these songs are very simple structured, you know, the lullabies. And then I think they were not only the babies, but the animals are drawn to the human compassion in the singer's voice and the familiarity of the heartbeat. You know, a search dog can hear a heartbeat from 75 feet away. And so I think it's because, you know, I know we're not talking about the dogs yet, but you never saw a dog pat its paw to a rock and roll record, so they don't relate to music exactly the same way as humans do. But if you're a hit record producer, you know how to evoke emotional responses in listeners so much so that they want to buy your record. But that's because you're human too, and you know what would respond to.
Right, you're working kind of for a different constituency at a certain point. Yeah, so
to say that I really designed one for dogs, I can't really honestly say I did. It was more accidentally discovered by other people, you know, that it worked.
Yeah, well, that's interesting in itself because it sounds like, if I recall my canine lullaby history here, that it was a family that I guess was using the lullabies for one or more babies, that they also had a family dog, and I think, did they, notice that the impact it was having on the dog as well?
Well, there was a family up in North Dakota that had a dog that was in a coma, and the little kids wanted to play their Baby Go to Sleep CD, which is what it was called, for their dog. And the dog came out of the coma, and they sent me an email. But I hate to admit this, but I got emails and phone calls for 13 years about how people would play the baby heartbeat lullabies for their dog, and it would calm them and keep them from barking. And I just kind of said, oh, come on.
Meaning you didn't believe it, really? Or just...
Because I just couldn't imagine why.
Uh-huh.
I'm one of those people. I want to know why.
Sure.
It's really real. Are you people reading things into this, you know?
Yeah.
But it got intense. I had trainers that had hurt dogs calling. And so I did an article for the American Boarding Kennels Association, and I told them what had been going on. Would you try it? And I took the baby CD, and I put a paper label on it and a picture of a dog, and I called the Canine Lullabies Research Done on Human Babies First. So I thought that was kind of fun. And then
yeah.
I had 94 kennels that have reduced diarrhea, stopped the barking, kept the dogs calm. And I thought, well, of course, and I did have one up in the Northeast who said that they thought my music was a little strange and that their dogs were more cultured and preferred smooth jazz.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, everybody's a critic, I guess, right? Yeah, that's funny.
But anyway, but I didn't even then believe it for sure until I got invited by my local Colorado Springs Humane Society, and I'd sent them out locally, of course, and they said, we'd like to talk to you about these canine lullabies and get them for some other locations in Denver and so forth, and they didn't know I was only a mile and a half away. And she said, well, how much? And I said, well, I give them free to Humane Society, shelters, animal clinics. How many do you want? She said, 8. I said, would you like them hand-delivered?
Wow.
It was my first time in a Humane Society. And I went down there, and I was going to tell her all about the story about the babies in the cardiac recovery unit. And she looked at me, and she said, these are my babies. She said, you want to see it work? I said, it was 2 in the afternoon. I said, yeah. So we went in there, and I'm walking down the aisle, and all the dogs are jumping and barking, and I'm a little uncomfortable, and she had an old boombox down in the corner. She turned it on, and within 15 seconds, every dog laid down in their kennel, and it freaked me out. I said, let it keep playing. I'm going to walk back down the aisle. I walked back down the aisle, and not one dog paid attention to me. So I knew, I didn't know how important it was, but I knew it really worked. And from that point on, I just took the same music and packaged it for dogs. And now it's being used in probably 2,600 humane societies and shelters. So it's to spread word of mouth. I mean, it's hard to believe. I didn't believe it for 13 years, so it's hard for me to be critical of people who don't believe it until they see it, you know.
So, Terry, just so I'm clearing this, so if it was after getting those calls and emails, messages, whatever, for 13 years that you had this encounter at the Colorado Springs
right.
Humane Society?
Well, then I knew it was for real. But
right. But for those 13 years, you just thought, okay, people are full of it, or I just don't believe this, or they're drawing conclusions that aren't necessarily...
You know how people will portray human characteristics on their animals?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe it's because it's calming the owner down. You know,
okay, yeah.
As opposed to the dog. So yeah. I didn't have a reason. Of course, after that, I started studying dogs, and I said, I'm going to come up with some kind of a reason for it. And I found out that in the inner ear, dogs have the ability to block out sounds they don't want to hear, and they have extreme selective listening where they can pick out a sound and focus on it. You know, if you have a dog in the living room, the TV's going and all that, and all of a sudden the dog jumps up and the ears perk up, and they're hearing something you don't even hear, and they hear up to 50,000 cycles. So you had to figure they've got to have some way to block out all this sound and focus on things, so that it'll be ADHD. And so, not that I'm a vet, you know, or not that I'm a pediatrician, but, you know, I think a lot of times you apply common sense, and if you look into things and learn about dogs and how they respond and how they're trained and so forth, that my little theory makes sense to me, but the only way you really know is if you're a dog.
Well, so how, in these 2,500, 2,600 facilities across the country that are using canine lullabies, how are they most commonly used? Like, is it played at certain times of the day? Is it always going? How do people actually implement the canine?
Well, you sure don't want it to be playing 24 hours a day, or all the vet techs and the people taking care of the dogs are going to say we can't take it anymore.
Right. No, I'm wondering about that, especially with the nurses already, you've said in the baby ward, like, said, oh, my God, please get us some different songs, right?
Yeah. It's making me sleepy. The times they use it are when the dogs are agitated, and also at bedtime. And they can let it play all night long at bedtime, because what happens is the dogs will tune it in and tune it out. If there's something disturbing them, something agitating them, they'll tune it in and get away from it, because they're trying to go to that order out of the chaos if there's a lot of other dogs barking. And they'll tune it. They don't need to listen to it if they're comfortable in their sleep. But if they wake up, there it is right there to calm them back to sleep. In homes, they use it for separation anxiety when you have to leave a dog at home. And they let it play all day long. But it's usually just when a dog's upset, or thunderphobia, you know, or fireworks. You play it prior to the thunderstorm that's coming. And these dogs will learn to focus on that. And I don't know that they could block out some of those big Florida thunder claps, because I can't block it out. It even frightens me sometimes. But they can block out most of it, and they're not afraid like they usually are. And they don't go, you know, hide in a little corner and shake all over. So it's just the times when dogs need it.
Right. But it's interesting that it sounds like in the thunder example that it's really as a preemptive move,
yeah.
Right, to play it for them before the thunder comes.
Well, they become conditioned to calming to those lullabies.
Yeah.
So they know what that he it's time to be calm and get focused on this. And so I think that's what's happening on the thunderphobia.
Sure. Well, let the folks know again. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Terry Woodford. We're talking about the Canine Lullabies, music he created to calm frightened dogs in shelters and rescue settings, and as we're hearing in other situations as well. But in those situations, it helps make them more adoptable. And so we invite you to join the conversation or ask any question you might have or comment for Terry by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org or texting 813-433-0885. So how important, Terry, is the song as a longtime song guy relative to the heartbeat in these canine lullabies?
Well, certainly the lyrics don't mean anything to the dogs.
Right, right.
However, these melodies were written, some of them, by the greatest composers of all time, intentionally to calm. Most classical music is too sophisticated, too mathematically complex, but Brahms' Lullaby, right? He wrote that melody because he knew that would be calming. And so the lyrics don't mean anything, but the way they're sung with the compassion.
When you mentioned that earlier, that really struck me about how the babies, in your view, obviously the dogs, are responding to the way that vocal, if that's the right term in this case, is delivered, and the sort of compassion, I guess, that's implied in that performance.
And, of course, I used the best singers. You know, they were all from here in Muscle Shoals, and a lot of them would carry little dolls when they were singing, you know. And I said, I don't want to hear your identity. I want you to sing it straight so mamas can sing along with it, you know,
yeah.
And not feel so intimidated. So getting the compassion was something that they normally weren't trying to do, that, you know, you're not trying to calm your listeners. And so to sing with that kind of compassion was, some singers couldn't do it.
Yeah, it's sort of counterintuitive,
yeah.
Really. Yeah. Well, with that in mind, let's hear just a little snippet of one of the canine lullabies here, just to give listeners kind of a sense of what that's like. So. It continues from there. So in that one, at least, it was a good 30 seconds, I guess, of the heartbeat before
right.
The vocal and rest of the lullaby kicks in. Is that very much by design? Or?
And you notice the heartbeat never stops.
Yeah.
The songs, it just continues on.
Right.
I think that's an important element, you know, that to keep it going. And they are different tempos. They're the adult heart rate at rest. So they range from 62 to about 76 beats a minute. And so that was... You tried to apply logic to it, and when I recorded those lullabies, I was using the same techniques and principles that I'd used to cut a hit record. You know, most hit records are 2 minutes and 45 seconds to 3 minutes and 15 seconds long, and that's the same way these lullabies were. I had to make sure that long. You don't want to bore somebody to death with them. But and you know what else I think? I don't know, but I think that the smarter the dog, the better they'll respond.
Oh, yeah? Has that been observable in some way? What makes you say that?
Well, it's because I had two border collies, and they're smart dogs.
Okay.
They really respond well. I don't know that's true, but I kind of think, you know, these same heartbeat lullabies have been used with chimpanzees in a research project, and the chimpanzees really respond quickly. And they tend, you know, the basic, I'm going back to the basic principles of learning. If a dog is trainable, easily trained, they tend to be smarter, I think. And so I think the dogs that are easily trained are also easily relaxed with those same principles, you know, the simplicity and repetition and so forth. So that's just my guess. You know, I don't know, but it makes sense to me.
Well, that's interesting, because I was going to ask you about other animals, starting with, I guess, most obviously, have you been able to gauge the impact on cats by comparison to their canine companions?
Well, you know, it does work on cats. However, cats don't seem to have they don't react the same way when they're upset. They'll tend to hide and shake and get nervous, and it'll calm cats that are in that situation. And the other thing is cats don't bark and annoy you like dogs do, so they don't get the attention, I think, you know, that it's not as bothersome to their owners as it is for the dogs. But, yeah, cats even hear higher frequencies than dogs, and cats are smart. You know?
Right. When they're in distress of the same kind that dogs are, it's not as obvious. But what you're saying is that the lullabies still have the calming impact on them.
Yeah, they'll come out of hiding and come towards the music. You know?
Wow.
The other thing that's interesting, since they hear so much better than humans, you don't have to play it near as loud as you would for yourself. They can hear it, you know, and they're going to focus on it anyway. So, and tune out those other disturbing sounds. So you don't have to play it real loud. And, of course, the closer the animal is to the player, whatever you're playing it on, the lower you can play it.
And so you mentioned the chimps. I guess I was also curious, since there's a fundamental principle at work here, I would presume that the impact applies to any number of other animals. I mean,
mainly mammals.
Okay.
I know some people have tried it with parrots, and I just don't know. I never heard back with them, you know, whether that was the case or not. But if they're mammals, I think it will affect them the same way. And again, if it's an animal's trainable. Now, of course, parrots are trainable, but is it the same kind of thing? I don't know.
Well, I was curious, like, for example, if these lullabies might be used or have been used even in sanctuaries, for example, where there would be mammals of one kind or another, for example, that to calm them and to do some of the same things. They're not subject to the same stuff necessarily, but some of them that have ended up there have been through some fairly hellish experiences. So just wonder.
Well, I know they were playing them in a zoo, but I do know one animal that really responds well. And I've always hoped that, you know, the people that raise pigs and hogs would learn about it, because these animals are really smart and they'll respond to it as well. And, of course, they have unique problems, you know, with pigs sometimes rolling over on the babies and different kinds of things. The little other pigs eating the tails of the runts. And so it's always exciting for me to see, you know, the other possibilities, of which it's mostly been people who've used it that came up with them, not me. I didn't go out and say, ooh, let's see if it works on some other kind of animal. I haven't ever done that. You know,
yeah.
I don't aggressively do that, but I respond to anybody that has had some results, you know. And, of course, you can't just be one situation. I think the thing that's interesting is it generically works on a lot of animals.
But it's interesting. It sounds like your theory so far involved, A, that there tend to be mammals, B, that inherently, at least, the smarter the animal, the more likely it is to have greater impact.
Right. Well, in the same heartbeat lullabies, there was a research project that was just done about a year and a half ago at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, and they played it for people with Alzheimer's, extreme dementia, and they played it twice a week for 30 minutes for 6 weeks, and their demented behavior was dramatically reduced, and their cognitive abilities were dramatically increased. To me, that's really exciting, you know, and so here I am, I've got three fronts to be on, and I don't know which one to give the most attention to, and I have no idea how you're going to convince people that it's for real until they try it themselves.
Well, what do you suppose in the humans there, with the difference in terms of the cognitive thing, what do you think's going on? Because to me, those seems like largely different principles at work than...
If you have Alzheimer's, you have poor short-term memory and good long-term memory. And when people hear this, they flash back to a time either when they were being calmed and shown love and affection, security, warmth by their parent, or when they were calming their own grandchild or great-grandchild. And so they flash back to that time of feeling loved and wanted. You know, 60% of people in these memory care units don't even get visitors. So this is certainly a way that they can feel comforted and loved. And I know when I first... there was the University of South Florida there in Tampa was doing a research project, and they asked to get copies for people who were being physically restrained and sedated in nursing homes. And, of course, at that time, I knew nothing about that. It horrified me to think they were doing that, but they tried it. And I got a call that same week from Lutheran Medical Center in Cleveland, Ohio, where they wanted to try it in a geriatric unit. And so I called. I started thinking about it. I said, why not make music when these people were teenagers? And I'll use the heartbeat, and I won't have any singers, but I'll use the same principles. So I took Moon River, Lars theme, Scarlet Ribbons, Amazing Grace, a couple other ones, and called the University of Alabama Cardiac Recovery. And I said, how about, you know, this music for your adult patients in recovery? And they said, well, yeah, we'll get permission from the surgeons first, and we'll try it. Well, I waited 3 months. I didn't hear anything. So I called down there, and I said, how's it going? And the head nurse said, well, I'm sorry, but this one you did for adults, we can't use that. Now I'm thinking, they must have done something wrong. You know what I mean? How could it miss? I said, well, what's the problem? She said, well, we bring them in right after the surgery, and we've got the boom box there. And they're laying there, but a lot of times the anesthetic wears off before the paralyzation does. And they can see and they can hear, but they can't feel anything and they can't move. And on comes Amazing Grace. She said they get upset. They either think they're dying, and it certainly doesn't look like heaven. So I was so embarrassed. You know, I didn't even think of that, but I wasn't going to give up that easy. And
yeah.
So I called the Lutheran Medical Center, and I said, how's it going? And she said, I'm sorry, we can't use your adult version. And I said, oh, Amazing Grace. And she said, no, the problem's Moon River. And I said, Moon River? What's wrong with that? She said, well, for some, it reminds them of somebody they loved. For others, it was a guy or girl that got away. And she said, it's your little baby version. It's just working great.
Oh, wow.
And I said, well, why do you think? And she said, well, do you ever listen to oldie radio? And I said, well, yeah, that's about the only place I can hear my stuff anymore. And she said, we're a referral hospital from about a 200-mile radius of nursing homes. And she said, a lot of the people that are here are people that didn't get visitors. You know, I didn't know what that meant. And she said, when you don't get visitors, you don't get as good a care.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So she said, so when they hear these, they feel loved. That, you know, they feel cared for. It reminds them of time when they were with their mother or their grandkids or whoever. And she said, it's really been helpful to them. So I knew about the adult thing a long time ago, but I was so focused on babies and neonatal intensive care units and places like that. I just, you know, you don't know what to do. I
mean, right. Well, yeah, there's not, like you say, there's a lot of different platforms for this. So we're in our final moment or two, Terry, but I'm curious, just because we've talked a couple times along the way about nurses and others sort of saying, hey, do you have any other songs or whatever? Like, if an animal is in a shelter or rescue setting or even at home, using it maybe to ward off separation anxiety or deal with impending thunderstorms or whatever, do they get habituated to the lullabies? Like, is there a certain point where it doesn't have the same impact as it once did?
It's the other way around.
Okay.
The more they become conditioned to it, the quicker they respond.
Wow.
It usually only takes one song. The reason I've got, you know, on the volume one has 9 songs and the combo version has 18 is more for the owner, because they don't want to hear one song over and over and over.
Right. Okay, so that really is unique to us. Because, yeah, I was thinking when I was trying to sort out the habituated thing. I mean, at a certain point, we all get tired of even a great song, but it sounds like that's not an issue for the animals.
Well, there was a research done by a woman named Dr. Sandra Trehub in Montreal, Canada, and she found out that lullabies, even with adults, were something that people didn't get tired of hearing, which I thought was pretty interesting because, like you say, if it's a hit record, 3 months and it's out. You know,
yeah, yeah.
Hear that anymore for a long time, but in this case, they don't get tired of those melodies, and at least that's what her research showed. So I put that on my website, and I even have a video of those 50 dogs calming in less than 2 minutes in the Humane Society. So
yeah.
That's the unique thing about it, I think, is that you don't get tired of it. And if you remember, when they did the first transatlantic broadcast over the ocean, I think it was Edison or one of those guys, they used Mary Had a Little Lamb, which I thought was pretty interesting. And the first record that was made, not the cylinders, but the record, was lullabies that they sold on Columbia Records. And it was a little 4-inch diameter disc, of which I have one of them. And I thought that was interesting. And I think it's because of the familiarity of those songs, you know, worldwide. People were familiar with those. And so that's why I think they selected that as opposed to some other songs.
Yeah.
These melodies are obviously pretty infectious. Some of them have been around for 300-400 years.
Right. They're holding up pretty well.
And
yeah.
Sung by some of the worst singers in the world, but they still work.
Yeah. That speaks volumes about the song itself. So, Terry, we have just about reached the end of our time, but we've been speaking with Terry Woodford. Canine Lullabies has its own Facebook page, if I'm not mistaken. And there's also a website for Terry, just Terry, T-E-R-R-Y, Woodford, .net. And you can find out more information from both places. And
yeah, that actually is my personal website. The canine site's caninelullabies.com.
Oh, okay. I just thought it was a Facebook page. I didn't realize it also had a website itself. So caninelullabies.com. Okay,
yeah,
great.
The shelters can get free ones also. They just have to request it.
Great. All right. Well, Terry, well, thanks so much. Been really interesting talking to you. And thanks for all the great work you've done for babies and baby animals and our senior citizens as well. Fantastic.
Well, thank you, Duncan. I appreciate you having me on.
You bet. Thanks again. Take care. In a few moments, I'll speak with Dina Athanasi of Animal Coalition of Tampa about its big fundraising dinner, Spaghetti and No Ball, happening this Saturday, May 19th at Yuengling Brewery in Tampa, emceed by yours truly. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. Some of the animal songs and animal comedy pieces we play can be a bit metaphorical. Case in point, this panel piece we're calling Horse in a Hospital by John Mulaney in today's comedy corner. Talking animals.
We like David Bowie and we don't understand taxes, so we're liberal people, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
So we explained that to them, and they said, are you sad? Are you scared? Are you sad? Are you scared? I thought, no, we're not, like, sad, you know? I'm, like, kind of an optimistic person about it all, so I tried to explain that to them.
Yeah.
That, to me, it's like there's a horse loose in a hospital. I think everything's gonna be okay, but I have no idea what's gonna happen next. And like none of you know either. Like we've all never not known together. And on the news they try to get people, they're like, we have a man here who once saw a bird in an airport. It's like, get the hell out of here. This is a horse loose in a hospital. And we're all like, it's not good.
There are worse things. But there are worse things.
Yes, but it's confusing.
Yes.
Because every day we just have to follow the horse. And some days it's like, the horse used the elevator. You're like, is the horse... You know those days where you're like, is the horse smart? And then we're all just like, why hasn't the horse catcher caught the horse? And then the horse is like, I have fired the horse catcher. And you're like, that shouldn't be a thing.
That was John Mulaney with a piece called Horse in a Hospital from a visit with Stephen Colbert about a year ago. All right, on to Dina Athanasi of the Animal Coalition of Tampa about ACT's Spaghetti and No Balls dinner this Saturday. This is Dina Athanasi back on Talking Animals. Good morning, Dina.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me.
So, tell us about the dinner. Given the name, I guess the event doesn't take itself too seriously.
Perfectly put, yes. This is a fun, casual event. We're just there to have a good time and, you know, support Animal Coalition of Tampa and our programs and services. So, yes, it's just a really fun, fun time for the animals.
Without getting into the cost of attending the dinner itself, what does the dinner represent in terms of fundraising for ACT? I mean, how does it affect the bottom line?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's one of our biggest fundraisers of the year, and 100% of the proceeds support ACT and its mission. So it's a big one for us. And, you know, especially this year, you want to come for the MC and stay for the delicious food.
Wow. All right. Well, I don't know. The delicious food.
Oh, come on.
All right. So, yeah, I have alluded to the fact that I am going to be emceeing the event and looking forward to it. And again, we've been talking about Animal Coalition of Tampa for years and years on this show, back when it was really just primarily, if not exclusively, low-cost spay and neuter. And then over the years, ACT has widened out to continue to offer those services, but also low-cost veterinary services that go beyond spay and neuter. So I know a lot of people listening to Talk Animals and WMNF, even if they don't listen to Talk Animals, and just generally have availed themselves of ACT's service. So I'm happy to try to help out. So what all happens at the dinner Saturday? I mean, there's food, obviously. It is a dinner. But what else is going to go on over the course of the evening?
Well, we've got some live music. And actually, even that's going to be a lot of fun and campy. We've got ukulele players.
Yay.
That are going to come in, yes, that are going to come in and play while we eat. And we've got a great silent auction. I'm so touched and humbled by the community and how they've supported us. And we've just got some amazing items that were donated to us. There's something for everyone. Sports fans, we've got light autographed lightning gear. We've got high-end items from Neiman Marcus. We've got dog baskets, Green Dog Wash, Joni's Pet Salon. We've got all of these wonderful donations. We've got a photography dark light portrait studios donated a photo session that you could have your pet at. So it's going to be a lot of fun, yeah, and we're going to just have a great time.
Okay, so we have just a little bit less than a minute probably, Dina. So why don't we, before we wrap up here, tell folks where, either in terms of website and or a Facebook page, where they could find out more information about the dinner, and if they're inclined to get tickets, where they could look into those as well.
Absolutely. It's right on our homepage of our website, which is actampa.org. AC like Animal Coalition, the word tampa.org.
Okay, cool. And so the whole lowdown's there. And I think there is a Facebook, at least event page, if I'm not mistaken, right? So people who are maybe even on Facebook as we speak can just go right directly there and probably get the lowdown as well.
Absolutely. And we'll have fun contests throughout the night, and we'll be doing giveaways, and there's door prizes. So it's a lot of fun for a good cause.
That's great. Okay, well, this is going to be cool. I look forward to seeing you Saturday night, and maybe we'll see some other talking animals types out there as well. And it's going to be a really great time, and for obviously a great cause to continue to provide those kind of low-cost services. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Duncan.
All right, take care. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lurie and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott in the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Just want to let you know that next week on Talking Animals, my guest will be Kristen Auerbach, who is now the head of the Pima Animal Care Center in Tucson, Arizona. But before that, for a number of years, helped lead the Austin Animal Center, which has the highest life-saving rate of any large city shelter in the country. So she's really a pioneering and prominent figure in the animal shelter world, and really look forward to talking with Kristen now that she's kind of at a new job and putting her mark on yet another shelter and helping save that many more animal lives. So that'll be next Wednesday on Talk Animals right here on WNF at 10 a.m. Meanwhile, I hope you'll continue making a donation via the Talking Animals tip jar, which you can access by going to WNF.org and finding Talking Animals on the schedule, and then just click on the schedule, and right up top, there'll be a little place to slip a few bucks into the tip jar. Would really appreciate it. Help us get a running start for the fund drive, which again starts 2 weeks from this morning. So hope to invite you to join. To a visit, I should say, Talking Animals Net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there too. And there are links to the Facebook page, Twitter feed, and more. So you can also subscribe to our e-newsletter there. Find out about guests and other interesting tidbits from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals, on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Community Conscious Radio, homegrown handpicked music and news. NPR News is next, and then Rob Laurie up with Radioactivity. Thanks.